Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Good day, good friends. Good to see you again on the Bill Press Pod. Well, campaign 2024 is underway. Both President Biden and Donald Trump are off and running. But you know what? What I find even more interesting than whatever Joe Biden and Donald Trump are up to is what a lot of top Republicans are doing to urge their fellow Republicans not to vote for Donald Trump. And I'm talking about people who knew him best, like former White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, former Trump Defense Secretary Mike Esper, former Deputy White House Press Secretary Sarah Matthews, and a whole bunch of others. And their message is twofold. First, we've seen Donald Trump up close. We know how dangerous he is. So as a Republican, as a conservative, as someone who loves this country, we urge you, do not vote for Donald Trump. And they've got a whole organization out there called Republican Voters Against Trump, which is putting this message out there. And of course, their second message is, as tough as it might be for you to vote for a Democrat, the best thing you can do for your country right now is to vote for Joe Biden. Hey, that's a powerful message. And that message alone, if it reaches enough Republican voters, could decide this election. One of those leading that effort is our guest today on the Bill Press Pod, Bill Kristol, a lifelong Republican, former chief of staff to Vice President Dan Quayle, former publisher of the Weekly Standard, and now editor-at-large of the Bulwark newsletter. He's about as Republican as you can get. Bill Kristol, it's good to reconnect with you. Welcome back to the Bill Press Pod.
Hey, Bill. Great to be with you.
And congratulations on taking over the reins of the Bulwark. I've been a longtime subscriber. I thought Charlie Sykes has done a great, great job. But, you know, you're there now with a great team, A.B. Stoddard and Tim Miller, Mona Charon, and other good friends. So congratulations. Good luck.
Well, thanks. I'm only doing that morning newsletter, and only part of it for that matter. But it is a great team, and it's been a real fun, I've got to say, fun enterprise to be part of. As you know, this, Bill, so much of these things depend on who you're working with, right? And whether you really enjoy working with them. And that's the I do in this case.
No, good point. It also depends on putting out good content, which you guys really do. And I really look forward to it every morning, get a lot out of it every morning, and encourage everybody to check out bulwark.com like I have and subscribe. Become a paying subscriber too, I might add. So,
wow, okay. Now we're talking.
You know? Bill, there's so much on the political landscape to talk about. I want to start out, you and I have known each other a long time. I'm a lifelong Democrat. I think you're a lifelong Republican. But, you know, and we've been on the road together and done some debates together. But there was always some common ground. I mean, not crazy, crazy stuff, right? I mean, like, we both used to sort of, both sides would sort of accept that, win or lose, you accepted the results of the election and then moved on to fight on the next time. Or win or lose, you would not send an armed mob to attack the United States Capitol, right? I mean, this is not kind of crazy, crazy stuff, but now it's sort of people just accept it and dismiss it. What happened?
I mean, this is a huge topic, obviously, but you're absolutely right, incidentally. And it was even beyond that. I mean, win or lose, the politics stopping at the water's edge was a little bit of a cliche and not, you know, somewhat violated occasionally. Mm-hmm. Honored in the breach, as they say.
Yeah.
But I mean, I started, Fred Barnes and John Von Aretz, and I started the Weekly Standard with David Brooks and many others in September of 95. And in December of 95, Bob Kagan and I wrote an editorial supporting Bill Clinton on intervening in Bosnia and criticizing Republicans and in Congress were trying to make a political issue of this and opposing it contrary to sort of the spirit of Reaganism. It was a little controversial. We got a few people who said, I didn't subscribe to this magazine to read defenses of Bill Clinton, and they canceled their subscriptions and stuff. But it wasn't an act of great courage. It wasn't like, whoa, that's really amazing. They're supporting a Democratic president's foreign policy in this particular case, you know, while criticizing him on other things, obviously. I mean, now we're so far from that, of course, where doing anything that deviates from the party line, the tribalism, is regarded as extraordinary. Yeah, the polarization, it is asymmetric, as the political scientists say. You know, the Republican side of the polarization is so much greater, especially with Trump, than the Democratic side. I mean, Biden is a pretty traditional Democrat, as you know. And, you know, the Democratic Party isn't that funny. Here's one way to think about it. If you came back, you know, been gone for 30 years and came back, you'd recognize the Democratic Party, right? I mean, it's big but ungainly coalition of interest groups and different, you know, ethnicities and regions. And the nation as a whole is more polarized, so you don't have your Southern Democrats and stuff anymore. But, you know, you've got pro-business Democrats and pro-labor and environmentalists and this. And it functions okay. And, absolutely. And Biden is kind of right in the middle of it. The Republican Party is totally different from what it was. It is a movement controlled by and obedient to one man who is not a traditional political leader. He's a demagogue. He's kind of an authoritarian leader, as evidenced by, you know, storming the Capitol and so forth. And so one of our two parties is just way out of kilter. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, the country as a whole has become polarized, no question, for socioeconomic reasons and geographical reasons and a million other things. That's pretty familiar. But then the Trump has just added kind of jet fuel to the polarization.
Is there a Republican Party left anymore today?
Well, there's a Trump Republican Party. And as we saw in the Ohio election a few days ago, you know, it is dominant in most states, the huge majority of states. And so is there a Bob Dole, John McCain, George H.W. or George W. Bush or Ronald Reagan Republican Party left? Not much. There are some voters. Nikki Haley did, after all, get, 30-35% of the Republican vote in the primaries when she was contesting them, 15-20% even when she's not contesting them. So there's a chunk of that, which is not nothing, right? That's a chunk of that party that's not happy about the Trumpian direction the party as a whole has gone in. But, you know, for a while there, we all thought about Trump as kind of this weird thing, phenomenon, burst upon the scene, will go away. And then he lost in 2020, and okay, he's supposed to go away. Then January 6th happens, and it's like, oh my God, he's really discredited. He's finished. For him to come back and win the Republican nomination for the third straight time, I just think it really puts the lie to the notion that, hey, you know, the Trump thing is sort of a temporary weird thing, and there'll be that old Republican Party coming back pretty soon.
Right. You mentioned Ohio. I'm glad you did, because that was certainly Donald Trump jumping in there. Endorsing Bernie Moreno. And I just wanted to play a quick bite for you, a soundbite of this is a Moreno, the used car dealer, whatever, very successful businessman, just before the primary, talking about what he saw as the importance of this primary election in Ohio. Here he is.
President Trump, J.D. Vance, Jim Jordan have endorsed me. My opponent's endorsed by the Swamp Rhino establishment. If you want the party of Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney, then you have a choice on the other side.
And you know, our friend Jonathan Martin said that the Ohio primary represented the last attempt of the establishment Republican Party to hold on to to a seat. And do you think was that significant?
I mean, I think, as Jonathan sort of said in that excellent piece that you're referring to, even then he thought it was dubious they'd be able to, and probably more of a, what's the right way to say it, like a coda to a novel, not the climactic point. And the climactic point had happened in the primaries and so forth. But no, it was significant. And also Moreno is much less impressive, I'm just going to say, than the guy he beat, Dolan, in terms of just, you know, normal credentials.
Yeah.
The person who ran third is a traditional Ohio Republican. It shows how far things have gone that Ohio, which was a state, as you recall, Bill, where the Republican Party in particular was very establishment and sort of organized, and everyone, you know, you checked your boxes moving up the Mike DeWines of the world and Governor John Rhodes going way, way back.
Absolutely.
Voinovich. It was a very, you know, kind of old fashioned, not always so moderate, moderately conservative Republican mm-hmm. Party. Now the two senators, the Senator J.D. Vance, who won in 2022, and the Senate nominee in 2024, are total outsiders, never held elective office. In Vance's case, moved back to Ohio, I guess, or back to Ohio. I don't know about Moreno's history exactly. But anyway, kind of much more your sort of Trump-type candidate. They both got Trump's endorsement. They won primary contests against more traditional Republican candidates, you might say. And as you say, it's how striking is that? Before the election, the two people he singles out for scorn, really, are Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney. Now, whatever you think of Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney's yeah. entire careers and their positions on things, you know, they are pretty impressive people, I would say, objectively. You know, I mean, they're not grifters.
They're not grifters.
They're not lightweights. They're not opportunists. They could have been wrong on things. I understand that. People are entitled to criticize them and oppose them. The idea that that's sort of the people you hold up as the worst case studies of the part of the party you are fighting against tells you a lot, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, you made me think another old-fashioned, quaint phrase popped into my head that I remember on Crossfire, Mary Madeline and I used to talk about this a lot. The phrase is the politics of personal destruction. Remember when we all condemned that, Bill, right? We would never go that far. Both of us would say, no, they went that far. They shouldn't get into those personal attacks, personal insults. That's all we hear today from Trump and other MAGA Republicans.
Yeah, we do. And there's no bounds. I mean, I remember being so again, things have changed. When he was president, I had like 1 second of hoping maybe he'll be better as president. It'll calm him down. You know, the Oval Office will impose a certain restraint on him that you didn't see in the campaign. We quickly saw that wasn't going to happen. But even so, I remember being shocked and, you know, commenting on it, being kind of appalled that, you know, he would call his opponents traitors. He would call the media the enemy of the people. He would routinely... Not just, that's one thing, okay, you insult your primary opponent, it's the heat of a campaign, it's a little different, give them sort of denigrating nicknames, but just routinely just attack mm-hmm. anyone who was in his way in the most vulgar and, you know, kind of unrestrained way. And I mean, who could even comment on that anymore? Does one even notice when Donald Trump calls someone a traitor or an enemy of the people or says he or she should be put in jail or prosecuted by the Justice Department when we have a good Justice Department under Trump or all those things, right? I mean, it's just taken for granted.
Yeah, it is. I mean, in terms of language too, there's the personal attacks. There's also the language that either tends to encourage or condone or maybe just accept violence today as part of the political picture. Here again, back in the Ohio primary, the one time that Donald Trump went to Ohio to endorse Bernie Moreno, he gave a very long, rambling speech. This is probably the phrase or the sentence that got the most attention. Here he is.
Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole... That's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
I remember Bill Clinton once saying, words have meaning, right? Is he basically calling for another January 6th?
I mean, well, so the bloodbath thing has been, as you know, quarreled about because he first seems to mean a bloodbath for the auto industry without his protective tariffs. Then he sort of generalizes it to the whole country. But whatever he thought he meant or whatever the crowd took him to mean in that particular sentence, we don't have to speculate about whether he's encouraging another January 6th. He also, at the same rally, saluted the January 6th insurrectionists, sang along with their sort of, you know, weird version of the national anthem with his own comments interspersed in it, the audio of that, them, literally the January 6th prisoners, the criminals, mm-hmm. singing from jail. He vowed to pardon the January 6th insurrectionists after saluting them. So he is pro-January 6th. Again, that's what's so astonishing, right? It's one thing to be kind of not willing to face up to the whole truth, you know, a little bit of rationalizing, a little bit of excusing. Maybe you don't vote to convict Trump because you have some fake argument about how maybe he wasn't certain it would cause violence. We're so far beyond that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it was great. It was great. They're the patriots. They're the, what does Trump call them? Patriots and hostages.
Mm-hmm.
That's literally at a time when we have hostages, when American citizens are being held hostage everywhere, not everywhere, but in Gaza, but in Russia. And, real people being held, real hostages by really bad regimes or terror groups, unfortunately. Trump just calls people who were convicted after rather lengthy trials and by juries of their peers for what they did, calls them hostages.
Bill, among your many hats that you wear, one of them, I don't know whether you founded this organization or you're just a part of it, but I believe you're part of the group called Republican Voters Against Trump, correct?
Yes. Yeah. That's Sarah Longwell sort of runs it, but I'm on the board of that, entity.
Okay. So what is your goal and how are you going up? How are you going about it?
So we did that in 2020 and then 2022 in a couple of the key gubernatorial and Senate races. The goal is to defeat Trump. The way we go about it, and we discovered this by trial and error in 2019, really in early 2020, was not by having slickly produced ads from DC telling people what to do, but having people speaking into their, the cameras on their cell phones, basically, and saying why they, people who were Republicans, I mean, genuinely, this is not actors. These are actual people who volunteer themselves on the website and then we vet them to make sure, they're not making this up. People who've been Republicans, either very consistently Republicans or at least occasionally Republicans, saying, hey, I'm a Republican, but here's the reason I can't support Donald Trump again. And that was the 2020 version of it. 2024, we've actually managed to find already over 100 former Trump voters who say they can't vote for Trump again. And so why is this important? It's important because a lot of research shows that if you're a former Republican or a Republican, still vote for, Mike DeWine for governor of Ohio, you still vote for Brian Kemp for governor of Georgia, but you're uncomfortable with Trump, you can be persuaded not to vote for Trump, maybe to vote for Biden. That's one step further, obviously, but certainly not to vote for Trump. Not so much by me, who's been against Trump for 8, 9, 10 years, not so much by Joe Biden or his campaign, but by other people like you, like them, who have been Republicans and who say in some of these videos, it's funny the Biden campaign was annoyed about some of them in 2020, but they were more effective because of this. And you'll appreciate that this is a former campaign manager. They were more effective because the people said, hey, I'm not crazy about Joe Biden. I've disagreed with him on a bazillion issues, or I'm pro-life, or I don't think he's great on foreign policy, but he's better than Trump. We can't have Trump. That's more effective if you hear that, if that's kind of your own view, right, than a glossy 30-second ad, Joe Biden, man for the future, those ads are fine. Those ads rally the base and so forth. But so these ads turned out to be pretty effective, I got to say, in 2020, and we put them on TV, but a lot of digital, distribution of them, and people all over the country, most in the swing states, saw them, and I think they had some effect. I mean, there were some Republican defections from Trump. That was the difference between 2016 and 2020, basically. So hopefully they'll be again in 2024.
Is your goal to reach 5% of Trump voters?
Yeah, I mean, I think the general view has been that I think 7 or 8% maybe of Republicans didn't vote for Trump in 2020. That was the number of defections. There were some counter defections the other way, but a lower number in terms of the Clinton voters stayed with Biden, if you know what I mean, than the Romney voters stuck with Trump. We need to keep those defections for 2024, right? Biden has to do as well in 2024 as he did in 2020. He doesn't have to do much better, which is kind of good, but it would be nice if he did better, and it would be nice if he got some new people to defect. And January 6th is a pretty good reason. As you can be a person who, you wanted to give Trump a chance, businessman, you didn't like Hillary, you want to change from Washington, 8 years of Obama. You voted for Trump in 2016. I mean, I didn't, but some people did that. 2020, a little harder for me to rationalize that, honestly, but Maybe you think, you know, look, the economy wasn't bad. He kept us out of wars. You know, there's a lot of chaos, but it was manageable. It was acceptable. I'm going to go pull the lever again for Trump. After January 6th, some number of people thought, no, we cannot do this again. And some of those people, of course, voted for other people in the primaries. And they're now here they are. And I think it's very important for people to speak to them and say, look, you're not committing to the Democratic Party for the next 20 years. You're not committing to not vote Republican for Congress or certainly for state and local offices. But don't pull the lever for Trump and do pull the lever for Biden. It's more responsible. It's the right thing to do. And so there's some receptivity to that. But I will also say, I don't want to kid anyone, that there's some receptivity to that, but there's also some erosion in Biden support. So this is a dicey election right now.
Sure. I attended a couple of sessions of the conference about a month ago in Washington. You were very much a part of the Principles First conference, right? I don't know if the Bulwark was certainly a big sponsor of that, and you were on the program. I was there for Adam Kinzinger, the keynote speaker, the second day. And basically, it was a group of disaffected Republicans, I would say, right? Center or right of center people.
Mostly.
And Adam said, I just want you all to know, I'm a Republican, I'm a conservative, I always have been, that's who I am. But if it comes down to Donald Trump versus Joe Biden, I'm voting for Joe Biden. I mean, he put it right out there. Is that part of your message?
Yeah. And Adam is we work quite closely with him. So, I mean, we have had people on the videos who don't take that last step and just don't say who, you know, mm-hmm. whether they're voting for Biden, or some of them say, I'm going to sit it out and just vote down ballot. And obviously, from a political point of view, as you know, it's better to get the switch over, the full reversal of the vote. You know, you go from minus one to plus one. But if you can go from minus one to zero and the person sits it out at the presidential level, that's still better than nothing. So that's sort of the Mike Pence option, let's say. We have the Kinzinger option, which is embrace Biden for now, at least, for the election. There's the Mike Pence option, which is don't, you know, say you're not going to vote for Biden. You have all kinds of problems with him, but you're not going to vote for Trump. I think Pence is the most important new news in that respect. I mean, it's not that he has huge support among Republicans. He didn't do that great in the Republican presidential primary, obviously. I guess got out before any votes were cast, right? But still, you know, he was Trump's vice president. I mean, at some point, that's the other thing we're going to do this year is former Trump officials.
I was going to ask you about them because
that's very important. I mean,
a lot of them.
And yeah. Again, if you're kind of on the fence and you don't like a lot of things about fairly or unfairly about the Biden administration or the Democrats in Congress or the left, you know, and you want to talk yourself into Trump, I think having everyone from Trump's vice president through his secretaries of defense, through his chiefs of staff, through people who work very closely with him, including in those last few weeks, all saying, no, you can't be for Trump. It's just too irresponsible. I think that really can have an effect. So, how much Mike Pence is going to be willing to say, I don't know. But if you were at that Principles First conference, you might have seen the panel with Cassidy Hutchinson and Sarah Matthews.
I did. Yeah.
Griffin, I think. Yeah. So they're all, you know, these are earnest younger people who, you know, thought they were doing the right thing and worked for Trump pretty closely, really, all through the White House.
Absolutely.
Along pretty up close. Cassidy Hutchinson, of course, by now the most famous of the biggest of the January 6th committee. And, you know, this is a courageous thing for them to say, and they're willing to say it. So we're going to try to do as much as we can to help those people get their voices out. And again, they're not actors in a commercial. They're not celebrities who never met Donald Trump or Joe Biden. But, you know, I have no problem with celebrities and singers and actors and so forth, you know, doing commercials. But, you know, these people actually know. They saw Trump.
They were up close.
And they think he should be president.
Exactly. One of the pieces in the Bulwark that you wrote this week, which I enjoyed the most, I want to ask you about. We're going to take a quick break, but when I come back, I want to talk to you about your recommendation that no way should Joe Biden get on the same debate stage with Donald Trump. Bill Kristol, our guest here on the Bill Press Pod. We'll be right back. So for today's podcast with Bill Kristol, I want to give a shout out to their organization, Republican Voters Against Trump. Their website, by the way, is rvat.org. It's really great. And on it, you will see testimonials from all kinds of Republican voters, mainly in red states across the country. These are just average voters telling you why, telling other Republicans why it's so important to vote for Joe Biden and not to vote for Donald Trump. I saw one from Jill, South Carolina, who said, I don't understand how he can befriend Putin. Or Steve from Texas, Trump cannot be trusted anywhere near the seat of power ever again. These are powerful testimonials. They're good for you to check out and also good for you to send whatever help you can to this organization. I think they can make a big difference. Again, it's Republican Voters Against Trump, rvat.org.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back on the Bill Press Pod. Very pleased to welcome back today a longtime friend, Bill Kristol, who was former chief of staff for Vice President Dan Quayle. He was publisher of the Weekly Standard. He's now, I think your title, Bill, is editor at large at the Bulwark. A longtime conservative Republican, one of the leading conservatives in the country, I believe. And you wrote, or you advised this week, Bill, not only should Joe Biden not debate Donald Trump, but basically he ought to just ignore him and not make him the centerpiece of the campaign. Won't Biden be accused of being, you know, a chicken and afraid of Trump if he doesn't debate him?
He will be. And maybe, I mean, I wanted to make it sort of a controversial or, you know, attention-getting, honestly, a proposal to illustrate a broader kind of campaign theme. The details of whether ultimately he has to debate Trump in September, I'm open-minded on that, honestly. But I'd say his first instinct should be, look, I'm going to have a two-part campaign. I've got to defend my governance. I've got to explain why I've done what I've done and how I think it's made the country stronger and why we've done well in many areas. He hasn't got as much credit as he deserves, and also lay out a vision for the future. So the typical incumbent campaign, but I mean, that's important. He is the incumbent. We can tell ourselves till we're blue in the face that, well, Trump's also kind of an incumbent and he was the most recent president and it could be a referendum on Trump, which I'll come back to that in a minute. I think it should be in large part, but Biden has to do his best to mitigate, let's put it this way, the unfavorable rating he has as president, again, whether it's fair or not. And what for me, that means a kind of an Oval Office strategy. I'm not a big fan of this going to Nevada, you give a speech, you go to an ice cream place, it's kind of nice, you get good press for one day. I mean, does it really change any voters? And meanwhile, you're traveling halfway across the country and maybe you could slip up in the speech. I don't know. I feel like they should embrace in a way the kind of Oval Office, which is the incumbent. I mean, he has to make the best of that. Secondly, I do think it should be as much as possible, you know, also a referendum on Trump. And as I've been saying, people should be featured who can make the case against the second term for Trump, and also how dangerous that second term would be, how much more dangerous than the first term because of the much greater authoritarianism and they're better organized and so forth. But I'm not sure Biden's the best messenger on that. I mean, if Biden says it, it's like, okay, well, of course Biden's saying that. He's the president. He's fighting Trump. You know what I mean? They always exaggerate. This is where I think let Mike, you know, put up, if I were running the Democratic campaign and had $300 million, I'd put up an awful lot of ads that are just Mike Pence saying that's why Trump you can't vote for Trump again. It would be Cassidy Hutchinson and Sarah Matthews. It would be Mark Esper, the last defense secretary. It would be John Kelly, if, you know, and quote them and just very straightforward. And I don't, now this is hard. You've been there with these candidates, right? Joe Biden thinks that he, Joe Biden, is like a good messenger and that he's going to have a lot of ads with Joe Biden in them. And you understand that psychologically. And he is the president. I mean, I don't mean to minimize it, but I think it's, well, I really wanted to make the campaign, if I could, think a little bit about the messenger question and let the Republicans and the independents and the sort of neutral, the military, the retired military, let Mark Milley say what it was like working with Trump. That's going to have the impact on the swing voters. Biden has to, of course, the Democrats have to rally their own vote, and they have to speak to younger voters, and they have a million things they have to do. But I sort of wanted to make the point that the campaigns, in my experience, I'm sure you've had this even more than I have. You've been in more of them. I mean, the candidates and the people running the campaign always think they're the best messenger about everything, and it's hard for them not to embrace, you know, not to kind of get in the way sometimes.
Absolutely, yeah. It's hard to do that, but important. You know, what you say, I think, is also extremely important because you have to remind people our collective memories are so short.
Totally.
You know, how chaotic it was and how bad it was, right, under Donald Trump. They tend to forget that. Bill, I you have been a lot more active in and involved in foreign policy issues than I have. And I see you as kind of a hardliner, maybe, in foreign policy. Tell us why support to Ukraine is so important.
Yeah, I mean, we have a group called Republicans for Ukraine, which has tried, and not so successfully for the last few months, to finally get the Republicans to pass the support for Ukraine. So I've been pretty involved in that. I mean, I just think, A, it's the right thing. It's a brutal assault by a bigger dictatorial country on a country that's actually been struggling, but in a good way, to become a liberal democracy, and pretty impressively so by now, if you look at Zelensky's Ukraine. And the last thing we need is a world in which nuclear-armed dictators can sort of swallow up or just brutally, attack and occupy neighboring countries that are doing their best to be free and you know, useful participants, helpful participants, responsible participants in the international community. So, I mean, that's the first reason, but it's also so much in our interest. I mean, if Putin gets away with this, what does the world look like a few years from now? What does NATO look like? What does Europe look like? What are other dictators? What lessons do they learn? I think you just can't overestimate how important this test is. It's the biggest war in Europe in 80 years. It's, you know, there are many things going on in the world and many things to be worried about and many things one could, you know, quarrel about what the right U.S. policy is. But this one I feel is pretty clear cut as a moral matter, but also as a political and a geostrategic matter. So I think, and at first there was bipartisan support for us helping Ukraine, and there were many in Congress. But Trump, this is where, just see how bad Trump is. I mean, for domestic reasons, and partly because he believes in that America First stuff, and partly because he likes dictators, he's been leading the Republicans as much as he can away from support for Ukraine. And now it's a little more of a 50-50 proposition among Republicans, which is still sustainable because Democrats are very good on this. But Speaker Johnson won't let it come to the floor, et cetera. So, but no, I think it's really important for the future. If you ask me sort of like, what's the world going to look like in 2030? I mean, who knows? But I would say one of the key determinants, one of the really key determinants, is what happens in this war with Russia and Ukraine.
Did you ever think in your days, like in the White House with Dan Quayle or working around Ronald Reagan or George Bush, that you'd ever see a Republican Party that basically was pro-Vladimir Putin, or so many members of the Republican Party who were?
No, I mean, I guess I didn't. I think I was never as anti-democratic, honestly, as some of my friends and some younger Republicans, because I'm old enough to have, I actually worked for Pat Moynihan for a summer when he was running for the Senate. As a kid in college, I volunteered for Scoop Jackson, the hawkish Democrat.
Oh, I remember that.
From Washington State.
Yeah.
So, you know, I never was quite as dogmatic. I'm not taking any credit for this. I think it's just an accident of when I was growing up, as opposed to people who are somewhat younger, who really were just never, you know, saw these admirable Cold War Democrats or didn't think they saw them. Let's put it that way. So, you know, I was always open to the proposition. As I say, we supported Clinton's intervention in Bosnia and stuff. So I was always open to the proposition. The Democrats had different wings, and some of them were, you know, quite forward-leaning on international, you know, relations and U.S. Involvement in the world and stuff. But the Republicans seemed pretty solid. There was always that Buchanan faction. We fought that faction literally in 92. You know, I was part of the Bush White House, which they did some damage to us.
Mm-hmm.
But he ended up leaving the Republican Party at the end of the 90s.
Yeah.
And then Ron Paul got defeated. I kind of thought that had been sort of put to bed or, you know, shoved aside in American conservatism. And I was totally wrong about that.
Right. And finally, I've got to ask you, this is aside from the current political campaign, but maybe not as well. And that is your response and your reaction to Chuck Schumer's speech this week on the floor of the Senate, where he spoke very critical of Bibi Netanyahu and the way he's conducting the war in Gaza, and strongly saying that once the war is over, and he made that clear, there should be new elections in Israel, and Israel needs a new leader. In fact, if you will, here is Chuck Schumer a couple of days later defending that speech after he got so much criticism for it and was accused of meddling in Israeli politics. Here's Leader Schumer.
When you make the issue partisan, you hurt the cause of helping Israel. I gave this speech out of a real love for Israel. And if you read the speech, we called only for there to be an election after the hostilities had declined, after Hamas was defeated.
So is it kosher to criticize Bibi Netanyahu?
Yeah, you know, it certainly is. And he criticized American presidents. So I don't have a real problem with that. I think the speech was a little weird, though, honestly. I mean, I'm probably where Schumer is substantively. I'm anti-Bibi these days, very much the last few years, but also pro-Israel. And they will have an election, incidentally, when this war is over. And I don't know that Schumer needs to tell them that. There are plenty of, it's a free country. You know, Israel has a lot of politicians who would like to get rid of Bibi Netanyahu, and a lot of citizens who would like to get rid of it. And there have been massive demonstrations until the war. And now they're starting up a little bit again.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Urging him to urging that there be elections. And incidentally, yeah, so I mean, I think very impressive demonstrations, really, you know. So I just think it was a little, and look, I have no problem with the Biden administration privately or even publicly, you know, doing what we always do with allies, arguing with them, pushing them in a direction we think is prudent, sometimes even, you know, using leverage on them. It's a little just weird for the majority leader of the Senate to suddenly give a speech like that, though. I've got to say, you know, I just thought it was kind of, I mean, he is in the same party as the president, you know. Now, maybe Biden wanted him to give the speech, I don't know, to give, put a little more pressure on Israel. But I think it's conveyed a general impression of a little bit of like, well, what is our policy? You know, Biden sort of says one thing, and then Blinken's in the region saying something else, and Schumer gives a speech. So I'm not a big fan. I mean, I think his motives were fine. I think he didn't mean to do any damage, but I don't know that it accomplished a lot.
And of course, Donald Trump didn't stop there, right? Just saying that Schumer was meddling in Israeli politics. He had to go all the way, which he is wont to do, as we hear right here from the former president.
Any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion, they hate everything about Israel, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
So does this make Israel now a partisan issue?
Well, I hope it shouldn't, because, I mean, it's such a slander, and it's so inappropriate, such a mild word. It's so terrible that really Trump thinks he's entitled to say that. And it's bad that not every Republican immediately denounced him. He has no standing or right to say that if you differ with him on Israel policy, you're not a good Jew. And is he now in charge of who's a good Jew and who's not? I mean, it's really disgusting. And I think, again, in our day, if I can put it that way, 10 years ago, a politician who said that would just be roundly condemned by both parties. I mean, it's so way beyond the line of just a normal policy dispute or telling some of your fellow citizens, hey, I think you're not, you don't understand, you know, what the right policy would be in this part of the world. So, yeah, it's always Trump has taken it to the next level. And it gets back to what we were talking about earlier. I mean, just the routine way in which he uses rhetoric like that is so bad. It's bad. I hope it hurts Trump, honestly, but it's bad for the country because it's not like there's not a reaction. It's not like it doesn't kind of spill out into the broader discussion and it becomes kind of routinized. And, you know, so again, I think he's infinitely more guilty than almost everyone else. But the Republicans in general who follow him are more guilty than the Democrats, who certainly Biden has been pretty restrained in much of his rhetoric about politics and has tried to be more old-fashioned. But still, it's so bad for the country when politicians start speaking in the way Trump does there.
Well, as they say, Bill Kristol, on many fronts, we live in interesting times and challenging times. So I'm glad your voice is still out there on many fronts, Bill Kristol. Thank you for all that you do and your strong efforts to keep our democracy alive. And thanks for joining us today on the Bill Press Pod. We'll talk again soon.
Well, thank you, Bill. It was really great talking to you.
And there we go, Bill Kristol and Republican voters against Trump. But boy, we need their help in this campaign. I'm glad they are out there. Thanks so much to Bill Kristol, and thank you all for joining us. Now, we'll let you go. Have a great week, but come back on Friday for our Reporters Roundtable. Who knows what kind of trouble that the members of Congress or people at the White House will get into this week or people out on the campaign trail. But we'll wrap it all up with three of our top political reporters. As always, this Friday, Reporters Roundtable and the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.